Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
All right, I'm ready when you guys are.
All righty, take it away, somebody.
All right, it is time now to begin focusing and getting out of Gmail.
Was that the actual intro? I thought that was it.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to After Things. I'm Andrew Main.
Hey, I'm Brian Brushwood.
Hi,
and in this issue, talking over each other.
I'm Justin. I screwed up. I'm Brian.
My fault. I didn't actually introduce your names.
No, it's fine.
Yeah, Brian and Justin. Blah blah blah. So we've got a couple things to talk about. A little bit about what we've all been up to, and I think we want to start it off with two things. First, Justin Robert Young. Is on my Skype screen, the man to my right, who has been, you know, my bestest friend forever, and I've watched him develop. When I first met him, he was a shiftless high schooler trying to figure out what he was going to do with his life, you know, not really gainfully employed anywhere, whatever. And I'm proud to tell you right now, the man in front of you is this shiftless sort of guy who's not really going to be gainfully employed anywhere as he figures out what he's going to do with his life, but tells you all about it in podcast.
I think I was marginally less hairy at 15 years old, or you know, than I am now. So here's the deal, guys. I kind of pulled the trigger on something that I've been thinking of for over a year, which is to leave the Go Game. The Go Game was my day job where I traveled around the country and put on scavenger hunts for anybody who was willing to pay the coin to have it. It is and remains an amazing company that I'm very, very proud to have been a part of. However, you know, there just kind of comes a time where you want to focus on you know, the stuff that's A, going to keep me home, and B, has kind of been the, you know, I want to say it in a way that doesn't come off as too maudlin or too saccharine, but like, you know, as been the kind of love of my professional life. Like, doing internet stuff has kind of was something that I didn't have a whole lot of sense that this was going to be what I wanted to do. And yet the more that I've fallen into it, the more it has rewarded me, and hopefully I have entertained you guys, and it's about time that we take that to the next level.
There's a weird, I don't know, parallel, like making the journey to being a professional magician. There was some part of me that perceived like if I was getting paid, I had to show up with a bunch of props and I had to do dangerous stuff and I had to eat the fire and I had to make people laugh by doing the magic, because clearly I couldn't create anything of value just by running my stupid mouth, which is something I do all the time for free. I feel like in so many ways, our entire friendship, I've seen you orbit around the internet doing stuff for other people, you know, as a reporter for iTricks, as, you know, a co-host on NSFW, you know, as a pundit on various podcasts. And I feel like you're finally falling in, you're over the event horizon and you're going into the black hole of where you were meant to be, to go full digital on this.
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, it's funny. What's been funny is how many people didn't know that I wasn't already a full-time podcaster.
Yeah.
You know, that I've gotten two or three of those comments. It's like, oh, crap, I didn't realize that that's what you did.
Well, if you go to justinrobertyoung.com, I can see why they wouldn't know.
Uh-oh. Uh-oh. Yeah, what's up at justinrobertyoung.com? Oh. Oh.
Yeah, my Dragon Con schedule from 2012.
We really need a unified place to find about everything that you're up to, Justin, and all of your podcasts.
I don't know. Hey, man, I just quit my job last week. Raise a bubble.
You've been at Boodles for years. I feel like my mom. Like, I don't know what you're up to. I'm like, well, just follow my Twitter, my Facebook, and my mailing list, and you'll know, Mom.
Yeah, yeah. And plus, also, keep in mind, I don't post everything to Facebook because Facebook sometimes charges you to get the word out. So sometimes it'll be on Twitter. But really, you got to cover both the YouTube channel and the Twitter and also read the newspapers and the TV.
All right. Anyway, I didn't
come. We need a Justin Robert Young landing page is what I'm saying.
Sure. Okay. Yes. No, good. I'm going to add that to the big to-do list. But yeah, no, I mean, it's been very, very exciting, you know, kind of, you know, figuring out what I'm doing. And really, a lot of the pieces are still kind of falling in place of, you know, I announced it last week on the Jury podcast, which everybody can follow at jurytalks.com. And past that, you know, I've just kind of put it out to everybody like, hey, what do you guys want to hear me do more of? So yeah, no, it's very, very exciting.
So as you, I mean, you keep in mind, you know, After Things is all about the behind the scenes of artistic experiences. Can you walk out there is somebody who's listening to this because they have an artistic venture that they want to follow. Can you walk them through the stages of actually taking the leap? Because you are closer to it than Andrew and I.
Well, I mean, so my situation was, you know, about as safe as this could be. You know, I've, you know, I had a day job, and then really what changed the game was Patreon.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all of a sudden, because I had been, you know, even through iTrix, very, very good at building, you know, audiences between 10 to 20,000, right? Like, you know, for various things. Like I'm good at that. I had always been good at that. I demonstrated myself to be good at that. That's not monetizable, or at least to monetize it as we did, you know, for...
Well, it's not the kind of thing where PodTrack is ringing your phone 24 hours a day.
No, no, no. And like, even with iTrix, I think the Magic Week in Review podcast, you know, we maybe made, when I was like cracking butt to like cold call and cold email literally everybody that was releasing a magic trick that week, so I could see whether or not they wanted to try out a $50 or $25 podcast spot on the Magic Week in Review. We were maybe making on average, you know, $50 a podcast or something like that. And that was a lot of effort in terms of tracking people down and finding out who, you know, what they are and whether or not they want to buy multiples and spending time on the phone and via email and stuff like that. It was very, very, very hard to do traditional, what we would consider to be kind of display advertising. Like, I'm just doing a thing. Let me mention your product on this thing because a lot of people listen to this thing. That's hard to do with the audiences that we did. What changed the game was Patreon. Patreon for not only this show, or rather the Weird Things program, Night Attack, Jury, and Daily Tech News Show, chiefly, all combined kind of made this a job. You know, it made internet podcasting, as opposed to, you know, I don't know, letter writing podcasting, you know, it made this, this kind of element of my career enough to pay the rent and enough to pay my bills. You know, I then went a year doing both because it was pretty sweet to have two incomes and, you know, I could afford to do both, but ultimately it's like, that's only feasible for so long. You know, it's only feasible for Night Attack for me to be not present, you know, for only, you know, you can't grow like that. You can't grow the Jury podcast. You can't grow the politics podcast. And now really what the big thing for me was the Contender. You know, I've got three other partners in that. And we have collectively put a bunch of money into it. And, you know, we got a year. So how would I feel looking at the success or lack of success of that and understanding that, like, there are just going to be times where I can't work on it because I'm on a plane or I can't work on it because I got a game. And like, how much does that ring hollow to my other partners if I'm like, well, yeah, sorry, but, you know, listen, this is my side gig. Sure, I know that we all, you know, as a unit, formed an LLC and have committed over $100,000 to this. But anyway, I got to go do my game for Google. See you guys later. By the way, I'm in Tampa and I fly back at 6 o'clock in the morning. So I'm going to be really tired when I'm doing all this other work.
And you know, you just hit the nail on the head too there. And I think that's one of the problems in dealing with some people is that nobody has an idea of how flaky they are. They may know where their flakometer kind of direction. I know in some areas, like I'm super flake. I know this. But and you deal with some people who are like, yeah, I want to be, this is going to be great. It's going to be great. And then you go like, yeah, this other thing. And it's like, all right, we made a commitment based on what you told us. And yes, we understand your life is telling you got to do this other thing. But now you're leaving us in this. And you see that happen on Kickstarter all the time. There was a funny YouTube video that came out where somebody was like just kind of ripping into the problem of Kickstarter and stuff of these people who sort of just, wow, I got to do work now? Oh, I didn't know. Yeah. You know, but – and that's the difference when somebody gets things done and somebody doesn't. You're absolutely making that leap and basing part of your decisions on not letting – you were a very, very, you know, stable part of helping me accomplish what I wanted to do because I knew I could rely on you. I knew I could abuse it. I mean, I knew I could use that.
Well, I mean, and that's the biggest thing is that what I wanted to do was, A, at the bare minimum – I need a year to sell as many of these contenders as we possibly can. You know, like we've just made a huge bet on this. We only really have a year of like prime time. People are talking about politics and presidential politics more than they ever have by the numbers. We really only have a year to sell these at the volume that we really, really want to. We want to get out hard on the gates because we believe in the play mechanics of the game and we think that it is something that can last beyond this, but you got to get it in people's hands and word of mouth kind of has to happen. We're at a very unique opportunity for that. But beyond the contender, there's just been a latent desire for me to say, like, you know, never have I had more, and thankfully, more people that have enjoyed the stuff that I've done, and yet I can't feel great about, you know, how many times that I've called Brian or Brian's called me with 4 hours to go before Night Attack. And we're like, hey, what are we going to do? And we're just, you know, we putz around because we're both super busy and we're friends. So we want to vent to each other about the stuff that's going on in our lives more than we want to plan the show. And then we just go in, we end the conversation with. So anyway, we'll just, you know, we'll figure it out.
It's good. We aired this out. Let's go, I don't know, make something up on the fly. Hope we're funny. Hope we don't fight. Bye.
And it's like, you know, I don't feel great about that, or at least I don't feel that that's our greatest promise. I don't feel great about, you know, so a lot of the stuff that I could do and I have done with Andrew and collaborating with him more is something that I certainly want to do. And, you know, I just every time that I have a good idea or I have an idea that I feel is good and that I think could be awesome and I think could expand, you know, what I do and make me happy and be something that, like, I want to give the audience, I can't because I don't have time. And now I've carved out that time. You know, I think it's been a big kind of emotional sort of breakthrough for me now realizing that, like, you know, I've built up a lot of skills effectively doing two jobs. I was kind of professional internet person and then guy who went around the country and put on these games with no control over my schedule ultimately. And now I get to have control over my schedule.
And there's a bit of peace that comes with that. It's like I found that it was the easiest to be happy when you were never more than, you know, 100 minutes away from the next emergency to be done, whether that's making the flight, whether that's booking the rental car, whether that's setting up the gig, whether that's fixing the venue or whatever. There's something kind of wonderful about just swinging from monkey bar to monkey bar, always, you know, less than 2 hours away from the next one. It definitely has been a blessing to be able to, you know, focus mainly on online stuff. But I found that all of a sudden, like, it's a little more challenging to, you have to be your own boss because the schedule was your boss in your current, in your previous incarnation. Now you have to be your own boss and enforce, here's what I need to do to get ready for the next jury podcast. Here's, you know, the things that are on the horizon and the calls I got to make something happen for the Night Attack or the Kickstarter or whatever.
Well,
yeah, sorry, go ahead, Adrian.
Well, I mean, I was going to segue into what Brian just did.
Oh, are you talking about the, my big news this week?
Yeah.
Yeah. No. So this week, we had an epiphany, and it was late in coming. But after, you know, it was something that a bunch of people had suggested at various points. But sometimes you're just in the right place to hear it. When and the message that hit me at the right moment was, you realize, you know, the suggestion is, hey, you should make a second YouTube channel. And that's easy to hear. And it's like, yeah, no, sure. Also, I should fly to the moon. I should do a million other things.
You're going to fly to the moon?
What's the benefit of X, Y, and Z? But what got to me last a couple weeks ago was I was talking to an agent that was like, yeah, you realize nobody else who has 1.4 million subscribers on YouTube doesn't have a second channel. And all of a sudden, like a thunderbolt, it hit me like, wow, there's a ton of amazing stuff that happens that's off brand for Scam School, but very, very interesting to a giant part of the Scam School audience. Whether that's a 3-minute clip taken out of a Night Attack episode, whether that's outtakes, whether that's you know, stuff that isn't strictly, you know, Scam School Remix, Behind the Scam, or Scam School. And I just realized, you know, I was sitting on a mountain of content, and it was dumb, and I'm dumb for not having thought to launch a second channel beforehand. So, and on top of everything, it turned out that that we had, you know, YouTube.com/scamstuff was already set up and had the vanity URL and everything. It was already partnered and whatnot. And so, so we finally announced that we committed to doubling our content. We're going to have about as much content on Scam Stuff as we do Scam School. And in my mind, I'd like to pitch it as being sort of the left hemisphere and the right hemisphere of the brain. You don't get the full experience unless you have both. And in the pitch video, you'll notice on this week's Behind the Scam, we talked about, you know, we're finally getting big enough. We got tons of more content for you. We have exclusive tricks, something that's not, you know, really magic necessarily. And Jason and I, of course, you know, we are sitting on a mountain of content that was literally too hot for TV. This is all content. We have a bunch of ideas that were too dangerous and too they didn't pass standards and practices for National Geographic on hacking the system. And so we want to bring all of them to you. And in fact, this afternoon, we definitely are keeping that promise, because we we're doing irresponsible stuff that that nobody should do.
So, subscribe to your channel, Justin. And so we got two channels from Bri.
Yeah.
And you know, like, Justin, what are all your podcasts? Where would I? Because, like, that's why I went to your website. I was trying to find a one place where I could subscribe.
Hey, Ryan, jeez.
Hey, by the way, I was guilty of the same thing, Justin, until this year. It wasn't until Hacking the System came out that it was you that admonished me, like, dude, your website is a hot mess and you just need it to be a catalog of all your shit right now. I apologize for cursing. But now if you go to schwood.com, you could see Neshcom put this together in a day, and it's perfect. It basically says Brian Brushwood is made up of these 9 projects. And okay. Hacking Neshcom, the System, Scam School, Night
Attack. I'll pay you to do the same thing.
What's that?
Neshcom, I'll just pay you to do the same thing.
Okay. Same template and everything.
Just whatever. I think we found a solution.
Good.
No, if you want to support me, I mean, the easiest and quickest way to do it is to go to patreon.com/jury, J-U-R-Y. It is where you can support my one mic podcast, which is the Jury Show, which records on Sunday nights, as well as my brand new politics podcast, Politics, 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 which records on Friday afternoon, which was, I think, the first show that I've done kind of by myself where I actually just had a day to do stuff, and I you know, had a little bit, and you know, I was surprised to learn that a part of Ben Carson's story is that he attempted to stab his friend, so I mixed you know, another big Ben Carson story this week was that he had a rap ad where people were rapping about voting for Ben Carson. So I decided to put Ben Carson's speech underneath the classic Ice Cube and Dr. Dre song Natural Born Killers, which I feel is a better ad and representation of Ben Carson. I mean, it's a hell of a beat.
Right on. So was it this week that you released your how-to on the Kickstarter that you did as well, or was that last week?
That was out this week as well. We made $142,000 on Kickstarter, and you can too. It is up on Medium, and you got the full and complete version on the mailing list if you go to thecontender.us and just click on volunteer. But we went through, the four of us all collaborated on exactly what we did, the little lessons that we either knew going into it or learned as part of it. But this is, you know, kind of our starter kit on what we either wish we knew or did know and exactly how we did it.
Dude, that's very huge. Cool. What are you doing to promote the Medium post? I actually didn't know that it was on Medium.
Well, we sent it out on the mailing list, and you know, everybody tweeted it out and Facebooked it, and you know, we put it out on all of our official channels.
Oh, got it. So Medium isn't like a journalism site or a blog.
It's effectively, think of it as a like blogging platform that is more of a aggregate news source that like it kind of has its own sort of system in which it promotes stuff to the front page.
Okay, I'm typing in we made blank on Kickstarter and you can too. Oh good. Boardgamebuilders.com.
What?
I'm finding a blog linking to your post.
The Medium username is @contendergame. So if you go to that username.
That's wonderful. I just typed in, we made $142,000 on Kickstarter and you can too. And the first thing was a blog at boardgamebuilders.com linking, basically saying, hey, lots of really good insights over on this article.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, so that's great. So,
That was good. And then this week we're doing our article of how we spent $160,000. So. That really is the first half of the other part. The reason why that one's taken so long, we wanted it to be one big gigantic thing of like, you know, how like the rise and fall of all this money. And we've kind of taken longer on the how we spent it because we're still in the process of spending stuff and getting stuff back.
Are you seeing the light at the end of the tunnel on that stuff? Like,
I mean, really the big thing now that we wanted to make sure that we got right. We wanted to make sure that we could give an accurate assessment on, especially for printing, was U.S. first Chinese printing. And we are still yet, I mean, every day it's 24 hours away that we get our, you know, final delivery date on when the cards come in and when they go to the printer and everything, or sorry, when they go to the distribution centers. Just to follow up though on our conversation last week, my mom got the sample package that we had sent from John Teasdale's Amazon multi-channel fulfillment account, and we were very, very, very happy with the packaging of it, and I think we've decided to go with that as opposed to sending it all ourselves, with the realization being that in a padded envelope, we're going to just get more dented edges and more possible damaged units. And so even if we were to make $4,000.
It's $4,000 with the headache of, you know, 80 people saying, you know, oh, well, my mind was dinged. Can you do anything about that?
And also just the, you know, whatever that costs, and then reshipping them something if it just gets straight out damaged. And then just the enthusiasm cost of like, what if people are just kind of bummed when they get to the end of this process? Because for the vast majority of everybody that backed us on Kickstarter, this is the end. You know, this is the end of the story. We had a torrid love affair, and now this is the baby that comes from it. And it's like, if it comes damaged and dinged up, then it's like, all right, then how excited are you? How excited are you to tell your friends about it? How excited are you to spread the word and to put up your post on Facebook and Twitter, which is ultimately where we're going to get.
And your unboxing videos. Nobody wants to unbox a shabby padded envelope with dented edges.
I remember on these microphones, somebody raised the question of a padded envelope for shipping a park deck.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's certainly something that, you know, we, you know, having seen, and again, it's like Amazon's good at this for a reason. And you know, it comes on a same way that you would see anything else on Amazon with the, you know, flat cardboard and the shrink wrap fully on top of it, keeping it in place inside of a box that gives it plenty of room to get dinged around.
Like, that sounds great. Well, I have a little bit of a update. So I put out my how to write a novella in 24 hours.
Yep.
And that came out a week ago, roughly. I think, or did I launch it Monday or Tuesday? I think. And that's been hovering around the top 10 books on writing right now.
Oh yeah, I
did it as a free book at first, and everybody on my mailing list, I told everybody go get it on Twitter, told everybody go do that. And that was kind of I hadn't done anything to engage anybody other than, you know, some little updates about when my books from HarperCollins were coming out. And this was a new experiment to say, let me go back to engaging people like I did before and see how that works out. And it's been a wonderful, wonderful experience. You know, the book is now just 99 cents, you know, just a 99 cent. It's a pittance, and it's, you know, doing really, really well as far as staying in that category. And I've been giving them away. People are like, hey, I don't have an account, or I don't have this. So I send it to people. And now I'm shamelessly asking people, if you liked it, write a blurb on Amazon. That's how things are, you know, moving. That's how things are driving, you know, on Amazon. So if you liked it, please tell people why they would like it on Amazon. I would greatly, greatly, greatly appreciate that. And I have a new novella coming out, which I sent out an email to my mailing list, and then a little PS. I'm like, hey, by the way, if you read this far and you'd like to read something else I have coming out, respond to me. And, you know, I had a bunch of
people. Hold on, wait a minute, Andrew. You're kind of skipping over some stuff here. You've got a new novella coming out. How to write a novella in 24 hours was I think a big culmination of a lot of the lessons that you've learned. But how long has it been since you've released, you know, by yourself a work of fiction just directly to Amazon?
Maybe 3 years.
Oh, hells yeah. For the first time in 3 years, straight from the brain and fingers of Andrew Main comes to you a novella not touched by editors, by fancy editors in New York.
My amazing editor at HarperCollins, who will be working on the third Jessica Blackwood story, mind you, which
will
be coming out
next year.
She's
very fancy, and to her credit, very, very good, right? But this is something that I am very, very, very excited about, because it is your relationship and direct connection with your fans, the fans of your writing on Amazon, that got you the attention of HarperCollins and everything. And this is very exciting for me.
Yeah, I wanted to try to figure out, you know, as a hybrid author, a person who has book deals with publishers. But I realized that, man, you know, I need to continue and build my online fan base where I have a direct connection and I can be writing content that might be more aptly suited towards there than trying to go through a traditional publishing route. And I took the lazy approach, which was just, man, just do a book a year or whatever and that's it, and maybe try to get another deal going. But and that was dumb. And I missed that. I missed writing. I missed having an outlet. And the how to write a novella came from, man, I'd love to be able to write, you know, a 20,000 word kind of novella-esque story and see if there's a market for that.
I mean, the whole idea of releasing one book per year is an artifact of an old publishing paradigm, right? It's like that restriction doesn't exist anymore. And meanwhile, you know, we all know that, you know, the likes of Stephen King and so on, you know, could write, you know, an amazing novella by sunset. Why not open the floodgates? And so for you to do that, I think is wonderful.
Here's the thinking, Brian, is that I saw 3-4 years ago, I saw a lot of authors were super excited about ebooks, and particularly Amazon and Kindle, and mid-list authors who started opening up the floodgates and putting out a bunch of stuff. And my fear was, I looked at how there was this quality was started to decline in what they were doing, because they're like, people will buy it, I'll keep putting out. And you'd see these people championing
this is the new thing. And then everybody else started doing that. And then what happened is that, you know, I think that the return, the profitability started to decline. And I think mid-list authors sort of won as they killed somebody. There's the right amount, and then there's flooding it where people can't keep up. And there's the quality problem. And I got nervous. I'm going to back off. Issue. What's that?
That's the, I mean, the issue is that when you put out a book, you know, every 3 weeks, you know, that they get shorter, they get crappier, you know, they're less focused. You repeat ideas, and what you do is abuse the fact that there are just serial book a day readers, you know. And if you look to just say like, okay, well, I'm going to give you something, I'm going to give you some kind of thing to read, that eventually they lose faith in you, you know. Like, just because they read a book a day doesn't mean that that they're not discerning. And what excites me about what you are doing with this novella, especially having read it and very much enjoyed it, is that it just gets back to you having a real life, talk to me, interact with me, share my ideas, relationship with the audience, that for all the tremendous benefits and prestige that comes along with you know, what your relationship with HarperCollins, which is fantastic and brings you a platform for which is incomparable, you know, there's the danger of, if you only do that, that you become art under glass, you know, that you are kind of removed and there are rules for interacting with you. With this kind of stuff, it's you know, it's something that you're very comfortable with because, you know, it's how you built your career.
Yeah, I just wanted to find that happy sort of medium, and I think hopefully I've you know, the most productive period of writing I've ever had. This is what the new novella is going to be.
Game night?
Game night.
Is this related to night school?
No.
Okay.
Just no. Also has, in fact, considering some of the subject matter, we should probably never refer to the two in the same sentence again. Consider right. Night school is a school is a story in which a bunch of very hardy and well-intentioned teenagers discover many things about themselves and the world around them. Game night is a much more adult story and involves a lot of adult challenging themes.
So my question is should I think of a different title?
Game. Oh, it's for it to be confused. I mean, it is two night puns, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, and also both covers show people dressed up as knights and,
yeah,
in a modern day setting. Right. I don't know that you should change anything, because keep in mind, I mean, I unfortunately have not read both of them. So
And game night's like a hard R. Let me make that very clear.
No, there's, you know, there's more than two F words. There's adult acts happen.
That's the more than two F words is a reference to the MPAA guidelines on hard R, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
No, I mean, listen, there's sex, there's gruesome violence in game night. And, you know, it is, I'm excited for Brian to read it. I fear that I'm going to have to do the audiobook version for Brian to
Yes, I'm going to listen to Justin describing the hard, slippery wetness when his body parts slipped on other body parts.
Man, there's a lot of hard, slippery wetness. yeah, I mean, it's super good. But listen, if you like the kind of real politic of Game of Thrones, the people making difficult decisions in manipulating other people, if you like the one man's sometimes disturbing journey elements of Fight Club, then Game Night is for you. And it's a novella. I burned through it in like maybe an hour and a half, 2 hours. I mean, that's reasonable, right, Andrew?
Yeah, that's my goal. Is I wanna create these sort of one sit reads, you know, kind of adult goosebumps. That's sort of my plan, is to, you know,
hey, I'm not going to take over your week. I'll just give you something to do for the evening.
Dude, that's great.
I'll share with you my creative process.
You can only hope.
So in putting this together, I'm going to blend this right into Pix.
Yeah.
If I may.
Putting together
an ebook is a pain. It's you can make a simple ebook, but to still make it look good and have it look nice, it's still a challenge. 4 years since I first started, you know, doing ebooks, there hasn't been a lot of improvement there in the stuff, with some exceptions. I use Scrivener to write all my books, and you can output that into formats that then go right into Kindle, and you can do an iBooks. But the problem is you don't get a lot of really cool looking stuff. And I've seen some ebooks. I'm like, oh, they do really cool things with chapter headings and fonts and stuff. And I dig through like, oh, this is how you go into the HTML file. And this is how you do this, this. And like, that's a pain in the ass. And redoing the ebook for Public Enemy Zero, and then writing the one for how to write a novella in 24 hours. I'm like, man, like there's a lot of, you know, every time I got to do a new ebook, this is going to be a pain in the ass. So I went back and I looked to see what some of the options were. There's Pronoun, which we mentioned briefly, which is what Vook kind of became. And I played around on their platform, but I don't know if it's for me because they want to help you with all of your analytics, but it means every book you release through them, they release. So you don't have access to it on your own dashboard and stuff. And I tried to get some clarification as far as like payment structures on stuff. Like, you know, like they since a book gets sold on Amazon, Vook gets the payment and then Vook cuts you a check. And then it was unclear, like, oh, we're, and they're very supposed to be clear terms of service when you get paid. Is it 30 days
or
quarterly?
It's quarterly. Somebody, you know, back when they were just Vook, that's when I signed with them. And so I still get stuff quarterly, which is why we still haven't. One of their next things we have to do on Night Attack is find out exactly how many copies of The Journey we sold to raise money for World Builders.
So yeah. I don't know that that's for me. I talked to the people. I Skyped with them and all that. They're very, very cool, very, very friendly. But there are a number of questions that like, I don't quite know, and I want to have greater control. So, you know, the way their books get put together are cool, and it looks like they're going to do really neat things with analytics and stuff, but the quarterly payment, all that, like those were sort of deal breakers on it, you know, as far as I'm concerned. Then I went back and I looked at a thing called Vellum. And Vellum was a company called 180G. It's two former people who worked for Pixar, is like software developers, and it's vellum.pub. And what they have, it's a free application that you then pay every time you want to have them output an ebook. Now, the ebooks are gorgeous looking. I actually downloaded Mark Frohenfelter's of Boing Boing's How to Make a Trick Deck one and thought it was a very, very nice looking, very well presented one. The designs are really cool. They have really neat, you know, first, like, you know, chapter headings, et cetera. They do cool stuff. So if you go make a book in there and you, in the back of it, you say also buy and you list your other books, you can plug in the store information for iBooks, for Amazon, and for Nook. And when it outputs the different ebook versions of that, it'll put the correct information there. So you don't have to go in there and change it each time you do that. It's got some really neat features as far as just, you know, every time I'm like, well, wish it could do this, I found out, oh, it can do this. I've had a couple, you know, back and forth with the developers on it and realized that, oh, wait, you know, this is, it's a really, really well done thing. Now, here's the way it works. When you're ready to output your book, you can pay them $30 for one, right? And at first I'm like, man, $30 to go output a book, you know, like, I was kind of like, that's kind of, you know, seems sort of high. But then I stopped and I thought about it. I'm like, well, wait, if would I pay a designer $30 to go through and make something look gorgeous? Well, yeah, of course. You can get 10 books for $100 or an unlimited package for $200. I just blew, you know, $80 on or $90 on BoxShot 3D and some other thing just so I could do 3D box covers. It's actually to make your thing look really slick and professional. I think it's a great deal. It's actually really, really cool. And you can use the software to preview and see how it looks in iPad in different formats. So that's probably how I'm going to be doing game night and sending out my advanced copies in the version I'm going to upload. And I think, you know how I want to go back and, you know, I might go do all my other books through there because I think they look really good. So that's vellum.pub. And I think it's a very, very promising thing. And I'll do a follow up to tell you guys how my release with it worked.
Awesome.
That's exciting. So that's an app, right? So you download the app, you flow in all your stuff, and then you export it.
So what you need to do is you take your document, let's say in Microsoft Word or in Scrivener, and you need to apply headlines to your chapter headlines.
Yeah.
Then you import that into Vellum, and what Vellum does is it flows it through and it builds an ebook around it that works on. It'll create versions for iBooks and for Kindle and whatever, and it does really nice. If you go look at the designs, you'll see like the big, strong first letter, the little chapter headline that's centered, a table of contents, all that. Assuming that your document you put in there is properly formatted, it does a beautiful job of it. It looks really, really, really slick and very nicely done. And then when you want to do the back section, it automatically can create for you an about the author. You plug your stuff in there. You just drop in your Twitter and it creates a beautiful looking little Twitter, you know, logo and stuff. So everything looks super slick, and I look at all the time I spent trying to make sure my ebook didn't look too janky. If I had just dropped $30, my life would have been so much better off. So
I'll tell you what, that's absolutely brilliant. I'm excited to work with that, because that is, you know, it's a part of the reason why. Like, you know, I'm thinking now about the Santa book, and I'm like, do I want to write another thing to make it like updated for this year? And then I'm like, part of me is like, maybe I do, maybe I don't. And then like to add on to any like, no, I shouldn't. There's just like, I got to reformat it, and you know, I got to deal with it, and I got to make it look good. And you know, it just you sink so much time into just like, you know, making sure that every little thing works and that it formats right. And then you're not doing anything that, you know, then you have to catch crap on Twitter because, you know, the Amazon copy looked janky or weird or you know, words are appearing where they shouldn't. It's just so so time consuming and embarrassing if you screw up.
Yeah, I went through a thing where I would create like in Scrivener different like a Kindle version and an iBooks version, and then like put the right links in there to do all that. This does it for that alone. That's worth it. And you know, I didn't do an iBooks version for like the re-release or how to write a novella, because one, I wanted to do the Kindle Select program, but two, it's just like, man, I'm not going to sell that many copies and I have to jump through that many effing hoops to do that. Do I really want to go through the trouble? And now that it's, you know, drop your links in and then you can drag. I had a problem with the technical, it didn't work for me, but then I tried again, it worked. You can just drag and drop those sections in other books. So you can just repeat and do that over again. So,
dude, great, so far, great fan.
Dude, I can't speak for Justin, but I know that my pick is to go to patreon.com/JustinRobertYoung.
Jury.
Patreon.com/jury. Support him having a one-sided conversation with the entire internet. Do you have a goal? Do you have an unlock right around the corner, Justin?
You know, I think the one big one we have up there is at 1,000 that we will do 2 jury shows a week. We are already kind of doing, you know, the politics one is not something that you get charged for. You do support both of them if you put the money in. So I would say, yeah, go ahead and do that. But I'd love to get to doing 2 juries a week. I think it is at its best. A pop culture news show that allows me to kind of get more into my like journalism brain, like, you know, different perspective on what goes on. So I'm very excited to hit that.
Awesome.
I want to get a read of the room here. Did you all hear about Amazon opening up a bookstore?
Yeah, I don't mind it. I think it's counterintuitive and dumb in the same way opening an Apple store was counterintuitive and dumb, and the same way that Microsoft opening a store was counterintuitive and dumb.
All right, we started this weird things where, you know, that Andrew may or may not have to eat crow-flavored bouillon for how he treated his overzealous friend over text. There is no flavoring. This is absolute side of the road crow that Andrew has to eat. Because if there is one thing for which Andrew has used as the example of a dumb idea or a rumor that doesn't make sense, it has been that's like the rumor of Amazon opening up stores. I remember the first time I was ever on the Twit program there was a rumor about Amazon opening up a store or a chain of stores. And Andrew, I think it was when we were on the lecture tour, right? And you were maybe in the cottage. I'm just getting whether he was in the cottage or in Florida. I'm getting text messages as the conversation was going on from Andrew about how dumb the idea of Amazon opening a physical store was. He's just giving me talking points after talking point about how dumb this idea is. So the fact that Amazon actually opened up a store is something that Andrew definitely needs to eat crow for.
Do I?
Yes.
What?
Well, I mean, you don't certainly, if this proves to be a giant sinkhole of money and a waste of time and capital, then in that case, you can still sit on your, it was a dumb idea throne.
My positioning at the time, and I brought this up because I have been very vocal about this, and I may have done a 180 too, I'm going to let you know there. My position at the time was that the what's that?
You weasel. Just take the L. Take the L.
It's a store. One, my argument was they're going to lose money. And the argument being made was, I forget, it was, what's his name, was saying that they're gonna have to do Costco. They're going to have to do box stores, that they were going to go do that. That was the argument being made. And I said, I don't see them. I see them doing kiosks and things like that to move fires. Like, I have no problem with that and showcase things. But actual stores, and there is one store in Seattle that, as far as that I know, that is do you think this is a profit center for them?
Okay, number one, just full disclosure, I mean, Andrew and I have been talking about this over email and everything. I'm being a little silly here just to make the point. I think that many times when those conversations have been brought up, as you pointed out, it was looked at as like, oh no, this would be the like representation of Amazon, the website, and they'd have everything there, and you would be able to order something on Amazon and pick it up at this one physical location, and that has and always will be a stupid idea. This is as much a gift or a show of solidarity with the city of Seattle as it is them wanting to just test out what a physical location would be. You know, what I think kind of gets lost is that Amazon has right now locally a very strained relationship with the city of Seattle, that much in the same way that in San Francisco, tech companies and tech money and people working at big, gigantic tech companies are looked at as the reason why rents are going up and people have to move out and things are being gentrified in a different way. This, to me, very much feels like Amazon saying, hey, look, we're a part of the city. We're investing here. We want to make a great place for where people can enjoy, you know, we can buy books and enjoy them and stuff like that. So I think that there's a million different reasons why this, you know, either makes sense as a money pit, makes sense as a PR thing, makes sense as a dip, a toe in the water to say, hey, you want to know what? Rents are kind of going down. Maybe we can try something that makes sense.
I never was opposed to the idea that Amazon would be spending money to get their name out there to promote things that were they had high margins on or whatever. Like an Apple store makes sense in retrospect because the amount of money they make per product is ridiculously high, where Amazon is selling you books probably just slightly above cost of the store. This store's not making money. It is a money loser. If we see them opening up, I could see them opening up 10 stores, 12 stores around the country in high profile places, not as a business venture, but as a advertising thing. But the other thing is data capture, though. That's because I read, like, I sent Justin a super snarky thing from some, you know, Portland bookstore guy who's just dumping all over the idea. And I'm like, wait, let's see what they're on to here. Because when I first was nay, that was 5 years ago, you know, and since then we've seen Google barges and these other efforts where people are trying to figure out how do you get data in the real world. And I'm looking at this going, you know, if their goal is let's see if we can create word of mouth and presence. If they have stores where they can do author events and it can become sort of an extension, I believe it. But it's not a store like a store. I mean, it's an expo. It's a showroom and not a physical thing. And I would be – I will still be surprised if we see these things, more than 50 of these suckers open up around the country. I will eat that crow. If we see them opening these up in mass, I will absolutely eat a pile of crow in front of that place, you know, right in front of there, you know. Be yum, yum, yum. I was wrong. But I'm fascinated to see what they're doing with this, you know, because the conventional wisdom is, yeah, it's a money loser. There's no way they'll be able to pay for the square footage from the amount of stuff they'll sell through there. But they're trying to be data driven. And, you know, one of the criticisms is like, well, other bookstores are data driven. Yeah, I've seen their data. I think Amazon's got better data. You know, I think Amazon, if somebody can make this work, Amazon. Justin's got a smug look on his face.
Well, because there's an email that I got from Andrew Main on November 2nd where he links to me the Seattle Times article, and the only commentary on it is the one sentence, well, comma, I have to eat a big plate of crow over this one.
I thought it was real stores, though. That was the thing, is I thought they were building like a really big bookstore thing, and then what we got is not that. We got a bookstore, but it's clearly a you know, it's an expo showroom.
A showroom,
it's not,
yeah.
What's that?
Yeah, and it is just as much a you know, Amazon has done a lot of damage and is in a PR war with Hachette, and you know, it is looked at as this kind of the enemy of all publishing, and I feel like this is a you're just as much of a like, hey, look, we're committed to this, we're going to put money into this, and you know, we're
Amazon, you know, the biography Brad Stone did on and Amazon, you know, talks about how Bezos wants them to be loved. He wants them to be loved. And part of the reason why we love, those of us that love Apple, you know, we walk into that Apple store, we're there, we can be around it, we can be in the womb, we can be in that experience. And he wants to create this really super cozy, warm thing. So if you're asking me, you know, is it viable for Amazon to, you know, build FitMe up to 50 of these things or whatever in cities and stuff as a PR thing? Absolutely. That wouldn't have surprised me years ago. But I you know, the initial thing, like, Amazon's going to start launching a bunch of stores. And then I'm like, well, I don't know, because that would, but.
Will they? Yeah, no, I think I'm giving you a hard time, but this is definitely. I don't know. It'll be interesting. I mean, I think that there's a lot of you know, PR reasons for them to do it.
So we're gonna call these episodes Andrew Eating Crow over and over again.
I'm okay with this, for the record.
Andrew narrowly avoids three crows. real quick. Where is it? Oh crap, I can't find him. Anyway, my pick is Preacher. Go read Preacher. The new AMC trailer aired. It hopefully is only a taster of the character of Jesse Custer and not a look at the wild and insane world of Preacher as told in the comic by Garth Ennis. But I have high hopes for it. I hope it's really, really good. It's coming from Seth Rogen and his collaborator, whose name escapes me, but they have loved the comic and have worked tirelessly to bring it to either TV or movies for a couple years now, and I'm excited to see it done on AMC.
Right on.
Gentlemen, it's been after.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.